This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Sandra Steingraber is an ecologist, a poet, and a teacher. When she became pregnant with her first child, she focused her talents on what happens during pregnancy. She's written a memoir of that pregnancy and the birth of her daughter, Faith. The book, Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood, is about fetal development, the transformation of a woman's body, and the threats posed to the fetus by environmental hazards. It's also about the ups and downs of being pregnant and a mother, from joyful anticipation to morning sickness to the work of labor to the feelings engendered when breastfeeding. Sandra Steingraber is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Sandra Steingraber is visiting assistant professor in the program on breast cancer and environmental risk factors at Cornell University. She's also taught at Illinois Wesleyan, her alma mater. She is a recipient of the Rachel Carson Leadership Award from Carson's alma mater, Chatham College. She's also the author of Living Downstream, An Ecologist Looks at Cancer and the Environment. Her new book, Having Faith, is published by Perseus. Sandra Steingraber, her husband, and their two children, Faith and Elijah, live in Ithaca, New York. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Sandra Steingraber, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
And the kids?
They're great.
And the husband?
He's fine, too.
Good. Right at the outset of the book, you quote a Native American midwife, Catsey Cook. And she says a woman's body is the first environment. If the world's environment is contaminated, so too is the ecosystem of a mother's body. How does a contaminated environment affect the ecosystem of a pregnant woman?
Well, I'm an ecologist, so I spent some 20 years of my adult life studying how organisms interact with their environment. So when I became a mother at the brink of 40, I realized with some astonishment that I myself was now a habitat. So Catsey Cook's words about the woman's body as the first environment had this new meaning for me. So I really began to turn my scientist's eye inward and investigate the ways in which the internal environment of a pregnant woman's body exists in a kind of exquisite communion with the outside environment. And a lot of toxic chemicals that we broadcast out into the outside environment, whether they're industrial chemicals or pesticides, find their way into the interiors of our body and then across the placenta and form the first toxic exposures that our children confront. I was astonished, for example, to learn that pesticides like DDT and industrial chemicals like dioxins and PCBs are even now found in the amniotic fluid surrounding the baby, that kind of liquid bubble wrap that protects the baby, the fetus, from mechanical damage and is swallowed by the child. And indeed, pesticides and dioxins are even found in the fluid surrounding human eggs and in sperm. So even before conception, we know we have preconceptual exposures.
Mm. This knowledge about these substances, these toxins, have they changed how you live your life? Did they change your life during pregnancy?
Well, I guess I'm a slightly unusual person in that I am a cancer survivor myself,
mm-hmm.
And I know that most people don't live their order in the way that I did, becoming a cancer patient at age 20 and a mother at age 40. But that's how it happened to me. And so, the kind of cancer I was diagnosed with when I was at college at Illinois Wesleyan University in the 1970s was bladder cancer, which I was a biology major. So I had read enough in the medical literature to learn that bladder cancer is actually considered a quintessential environmental cancer. And indeed, we know as much about the environmental links to bladder cancer as we know about any kind of cancer. And I didn't do a lot with that information at the time. But I guess what I'm most well known for at this point in my life is my return home to Central Illinois as a biologist in my mid-30s, with assistants. At that time, I was at Harvard University and had a great financing from them and access to the best medical library in the world. 7 Harvard research assistants worked with me. And I did a kind of environmental investigation of my own hometown, Pekin, Illinois. Became an environmental detective there for a couple of years. And the result of that work was my other earlier book, Living Downstream. So I have a lot of practice pouring through cancer registry data, toxics release inventory data, looking at pesticide releases and things like that. So I guess it wasn't unusual for me when I became pregnant a few years after the publication of Living Downstream, then to start pouring through birth defect registry data, to start taking a look at the kinds of toxic releases, not of just cancer-causing chemicals, but birth defect-causing chemicals and neurological poisons, the kind that we suspect might set the future human being up, the fetus up for learning disabilities or attention deficit disorders, problem paying attention, those kinds of subtle defects that don't result in a physical malformation. The brain looks, grossly anatomically looks normal, but may not be wired up in the same ways because some kind of chemical sabotage the way the brain gets wired up at a key moment in fetal development. So it may be unusual for a lot of pregnant women to immerse themselves in the birth defect literature during their first and second trimesters, but that was a normal kind of thing for me. And I should say here that I actually spent the first 5 months of my pregnancy in Central Illinois. So my book, Having Faith, which is a report of my investigation, is actually set on the campus of Illinois Wesleyan University, where I was living when I was pregnant.
Yeah. With that in mind, I know this is kind of a departure here, but tell us about Funk's Grove.
Ah, Funk's Grove. Well, Funk's Grove is a very special place for me. When I was a college student at Illinois Wesleyan, the ecology professor I had there, a wonderful guy who's actually got his PhD at the University of Illinois in Champaign, named Lewis Ferner, took all of us out to Funk's Grove to begin learning the basic techniques of field biology. And that was such an epiphany for me. It's the point where I realized I wanted to become a field biologist and not just do lab bench science. I was absolutely hooked. And it's been a sacred place for me ever since. So that when I was really struggling with morning sickness, I'm jumping forward in time now, I returned back to Illinois Wesleyan as a visiting professor in 1998, and then I became pregnant, as far as I can see, the very first night I slept on Illinois soil again.
How appropriate.
How appropriate, I know. It wasn't happening in Boston. I was working really hard on trying to become pregnant in Boston, and I had to go back to Illinois to do it. So in those early weeks of pregnancy, when I was feeling very odd and nauseous, and I had my breast ached, and I had this sort of strange wobble to my hips, and I could tell that my heart rate was changing, my breathing. I felt I had been taken over by a new brain, and in fact I had, because the placenta was pushing into my body all these different unusual hormones, something I had never experienced before. So what I did was I spent a lot of time walking around in Funk's Grove, this place that had been so important to me 20 years earlier in thinking about how the environment and organisms interact and interpenetrate each other. And while I was walking through, this was in March, so in fact it was exactly 4 years ago, in early March, I was walking through the sugar bush out in Funk's Grove, listening to the sound of the sap dripping in plink-plink into the little tin boxes, and I had a realization that just as the sap was flowing from the earth through the maple trees, so too was air, food, and water. It was flowing through the kind of forest of my placenta and bringing kind of living sap into the body of my child. And that was the beginning point of my investigation that resulted in this new book, Having Faith.
Yeah. You had this this experience in Funk's Grove of in early spring and thinking about pregnancy. But you point out in the book that people have thought the fetus to be protected, to be surrounded by an impermeable, all-protecting barrier. Where did that idea come from? And, today we know about rubella and DES. But does that idea of the placenta acting as a barrier continue to have an effect on us.
It does. It's an idea that first emerged, as long ago, maybe as some of the early anatomists who were also artists, who were first understanding how circulation worked in the human body centuries and centuries ago. And then a very gruesome experiment in, I believe, the 16th or 17th century made it clear that the mother's blood does not actually cross the placenta and enter the body of the baby. Prior to that, a lot of people thought that babies' bodies were simply formed from menstrual blood. But we know that's not true. Unfortunately, by a truthful understanding of how the placenta is actually set up, a false conclusion was reached in the period of Enlightenment Europe, and that was that that the placenta must therefore be a barrier from all harm to the fetus. And there was a ghastly experiment performed in which melted wax was injected into the uterine artery of a dying pregnant woman, and then after she died in childbirth, her placenta was dissected to see if the wax had made it through the other side of the placenta and into the umbilical cord, and they decided it hadn't. And that was the birth of this idea of the placental barrier. But it persisted, this idea persisted long after we had plenty of good evidence suggesting that in many ways, although the placenta does serve as an important barrier to viruses and bacteria, in fact, it's very permeable to toxic chemicals in the environment and that can cross the placenta and sabotage fetal development. Perhaps the very first realization of that came with the knowledge that although the placenta is very good at keeping out most pathogens, that the rubella virus can cross the placenta, and at a critical moment in development, rather than simply causing a mild case of German measles, which is what rubella does in all of us already born people, at a critical moment in fetal development, that virus can interfere with the development of the eye, the development of the ear, and indeed the brain itself. So children born with congenital rubella are often blind, deaf, and have problems with mental retardation. That discovery was actually made not by an obstetrician or a fetal toxicologist. It was made by an Australian ophthalmologist mm-hmm. who was investigating why so many of his tiny patients, these babies who were brought to him blind with cataracts, why they all had the same birth dates. They were born in various places all across the continent of Australia, but their birthdays were all the same. And he realized while he was doing the surgery with them, he began to interview their mothers, and through a series of questions learned that most of these mothers were able to report that they had had German measles early in their pregnancy. So with that revelation came our understanding that, you know what, the placenta is not such a barrier as we had originally thought. And what we now know is that in some cases, the placenta can actually magnify harm. For example, in the case of mercury, which is a terrible saboteur of the fetal brain, mercury is actually magnified in concentration as it goes across the placenta because the placenta is kind of tricked into thinking that mercury is a precious molecule of something like iodine or calcium, something that the baby needs, and so it will actively pump it across the placenta so that you see higher concentrations of this poison in umbilical cord blood than you do in the mother's blood. So in some cases, the placenta actually serves as a magnifying glass for poisons rather than as a barrier.
Mm. Is there a particular period of time when the fetus is most vulnerable?
It depends on the kind of poison you're talking about. If we're talking about contaminants that lead to birth defects, yes. The earlier it is, the more dangerous it is. And, of course, the irony here is oftentimes a woman doesn't even yet know she's pregnant. There's a period of time we call organogenesis in embryology that occurs between about weeks 5 and 10 of a pregnancy, and it's during this time that the fetal body is actually assembled. At the end of week 10, essentially what you have is a tiny little human being the size of a paperclip with all of the body parts present. And what happens during the rest of the 30 weeks of pregnancy is this is the growth and development of all those parts. So if you introduce a chemical that has the power to turn on and turn off the genes that control for the chemical messages that orchestrate that whole process of origami, which is how I think of how a fetal body is formed. It's formed by the folding and rolling up of two-dimensional sheets into three-dimensional structures. If you introduce a poison during that time, you can get structural malformation. You can get a cleft palate, a cardiac defect. There's thousands of different ways that this problem can arise. Sometimes the same chemicals introduced at a later point in development might not have any harm at all because those body parts are already now formed. Or you can see another kind of effect. For example, solvents can not only create birth defects during that period of organogenesis, but if you introduce a solvent earlier in pregnancy, before week 5, before the body's actually forming, when the life support system of the embryo is just getting set up, because first of all, of course, you have to set up the whole life support system, the amnion and the chorion and the developing placenta, and implantation has to take place before the body of the embryo actually forms. If you introduce a poison during that period of time, you can raise the risk for miscarriage. Later on, you might raise the risk for birth defects. In the second trimester of pregnancy, that's when the fetal brain really goes to town, and all of these structures that were formed during the period of organogenesis early on now start migrating and linking up with each other. So you have this big kind of quilting bee going on in the brain, and that happens during months 5 and 6. So if you introduce a brain poison, that would be the most vulnerable period of time, you see. And then later on, of course, labor and delivery has to happen. And there are chemicals that actually can interfere with the timing of that. So an introduction of a certain chemical in 8th or 9th month might trigger premature labor or might interfere with the placenta's ability to carry proteins across itself, which is why we think that the children of mothers who smoke actually weigh on average a half a pound less at birth than the children of mothers who don't smoke, because elements in tobacco smoke actually disable the mechanism in the placenta that allows proteins to be carried across to the body of the baby. And so there's just less protein mass in the children of smoking mothers. And we know that certain kind of air pollutants can actually have that same effect. So the date of your birth itself, or your child's birthday, may not just be a function of the astrological charts or its projected due date based on when the child was conceived. It may also have to do with how much air pollution you were exposed to during a critical time during the 8th and 9th month of your pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's a pregnant woman to do?
Well, this is what persuaded me to write this book, because there isn't a lot that we as pregnant women can do. There are a few basic things. I think that avoiding chemicals with solvents in them is good advice, and that means avoiding paint and dry cleaning fluids. And these are things we do have a little bit of control over. A lot of women get this big urge to paint because they want to transform a room in their house into a nursery, or they just want to just generally get their house in order before the baby's born. But being exposed to paint is a very bad thing at any point in pregnancy. Being exposed to pesticides is not a good idea. 75% of women have known exposures to pesticides during their pregnancies, and there's some evidence from birth defect registries suggesting that the closer a woman lives, this is data from California now, the closer a woman lives to a field in which pesticides are being sprayed, the higher her chances are of having a child die of a birth defect. And some of this has been replicated in Europe and a few other states, Minnesota. And so we have some control over the pesticides we use in our own homes and gardens, but we don't necessarily have an individual control over the pesticides in, for example, our community drinking water. In Bloomington, Illinois, where I was living when I was pregnant, I was very aware that some parts of my trimester corresponded to the spring months of planting, and we have an above-ground reservoir there, and the creeks that feed our drinking water reservoir in Bloomington Normal, well, mostly Bloomington, flow through an intensely farmed area. Money Creek is one of them, and the possibility of runoff, pesticide runoff and fertilizer runoff from those fields is very real and has been documented in years past. So should pregnant women in central Illinois drink bottled water? Maybe or maybe not. It turns out a lot of our exposure to chemicals like pesticides in drinking water actually occur when we turn on the shower, because you're actually inhaling them when they evaporate. And, of course, you're also drinking them every time you have soup in the faculty cafeteria, every time you take your students out for a cup of tea, which I certainly did. So the idea that we should all try to create these safe bubbles, you know, and yet go on living in this toxic world bothers me. So what I wanted to do was write a book that wasn't one more book saying to pregnant women, do this, don't do that, abstain from this, watch out for that. Instead, I wanted a call to arms that would say, pregnancy is not just a private experience. When you're a pregnant body, your body exists in communion with the outside world, and the chemicals that are out there are going to get into the body of your baby. That's a form of toxic trespass. It's a human rights problem. We need to organize around this issue and become political. We need to recognize that transforming our agricultural system and breaking its current dependency on birth defect-causing chemicals is a form of good prenatal care. Having drinking water without fertilizers in it is a form of good prenatal care. Breathing air that doesn't have particles of soot and solvents in it, good prenatal care. And that would mean being inspired by other groups before us, like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, who in an earlier time, and they've done so much to make the roads a safer place for all of us, they recognized 20-some years ago that it wasn't enough to take a pledge not to drive drunk yourself, that as mothers whose children were being threatened by drunks on the road, they needed to get political. They needed laws changed, laws enforced, way alcohol was advertised in sporting events and the behavior of bartenders. All these things had to change, and they did it. And I think that we mothers now need to organize around reproductive toxicants and get these things out of our environment, insist that our economy and our agricultural systems find non-toxic substitutes for any chemical that threatens human development and make this a national priority. And I think we can do it.
Mm. Sandra Steingraber is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Living Downstream. She's also the author of Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. That's what we're talking about this afternoon. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join the discussion in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, we've talked about women in pregnancy, but then once the baby is born, there's the decision over whether to breastfeed or not. And if we're awash in contaminants, so too would breast milk be contaminated. You've briefed delegates at the UN on the problem of breast milk contamination. What did you tell them?
Well, I told them there are two true things about breast milk, and this is also the message that I bring in the last three chapters of Having Faith. The two true things are this. First of all, breast milk is an absolutely unsubstitutable food. It's far superior to infant formula, and in fact, the failure to breastfeed in our country, which has one of the lowest breastfeeding rates in the world, primarily because of our inability to provide women paid maternity leave and the free rein we allow infant formula manufacturers to have on in influencing how infants are fed. The failure to breastfeed in this country is thought by the USAID to be responsible for 4,000 infant deaths in the U.S. alone. In other words, if we enabled and empowered all women to breastfeed, mothers to breastfeed, 4,000 babies a year would not succumb to sudden infant death syndrome, respiratory infections, and other kinds of problems, and we would lower our infant mortality rate. Breast milk not only protects against disease and protects against allergies, but breastfed children have less asthma, they have less obesity, they have less rheumatoid arthritis, they're at lower risk for certain kinds of cancers, and they have higher IQ. Now, all that's true. What's also true about breast milk is it's the most contaminated human food on the planet, far more contaminated with toxic chemicals than infant formula or dairy, because breast milk exists one rung higher on the food chain than cow's milk, and at least two rungs higher on the food chain than infant formula, because the fat in infant formula is not actually from dairy, it's from plant oils. The higher you eat on the food chain, the more toxic contaminants that you take in your diet. And, of course, nursing infants are one rung higher than we are because the human breast has one more chance to concentrate the poisons that are found in adult food, like milk, eggs, meat, things like that, one more time. So that we know with certainty, and nobody's arguing about this, we know with certainty that breastfed children are consuming somewhere between 4 and 10 times more dioxin on a daily basis, on a pound-for-pound basis, than their mothers are. And breastfed children have higher body burdens of toxic chemicals than formula-fed children. Now, whenever I say that, I always say they're also healthier. They also outperform their bottle-fed counterparts on all tests of psychomotor development, visual acuity. They have better immune responses, et cetera. So we haven't yet compromised breast milk to the point where it's a worse food than infant formula. And based on that knowledge, I breastfed both my children. In fact, I'm breastfeeding my son Elijah right now as we speak. Another advantage of breastfeeding is it only takes one hand, and you can talk on the phone with the other one. And I breastfed my daughter for more than 2 years. But we shouldn't just say breast is best. What we need to do is get these chemical contaminants out of the environment and therefore out of women's breasts so that we mothers who nurse don't have to compromise the goodness of breast milk, that it can be as good as it's supposed to be for our babies, and we're not loading our children up with toxic chemicals right when they're such little people.
Mm. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on the toll-free line in Bloomington, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
There's a hotbed of interest in the work that Sandra has done here in Bloomington and Normal, and I'd like to invite your listeners to join us on the first Monday of every month to a group called Living Upstream, a group that has decided to take advantage of the knowledge that Sandra has passed along to us and do something about these toxins in our environment. We meet at 5:15 on the first Monday at the Ecology Action Center, and we've done several projects to help inform the public and to get out there and do some political work as well. The Ecology Action Center is at 202 West College Avenue in Normal, and we're right next door to the Normal Public Library, and there's plenty of parking.
Okay.
Also, there will be a book discussion group, Eco Readers, on March 14th and April 11th, discussing having faith. And that's going to be at Barnes & Noble in Bloomington, which is at the intersection of Route 9 and Veterans Parkway on the east side of Bloomington. At 5:30, we meet at Barnes & Noble to discuss that book at that time. And we invite everybody who's listening to come along.
Well, thank you very much for the telephone call.
Well, that sounds like the voice of Anne McGowan, who's the former, I think, executive director of the Ecology Action Center and a longtime member of this group she's mentioning called Living Upstream. And I just want to give my personal endorsement to both of those groups. I think the Ecology Action Center is one of the best things going in central Illinois. Living Upstream is, I've had the great pleasure of meeting with a lot of their members, and they're doing so much there to look at local issues, ranging from, you know, how to get involved with organic agriculture and community-supported agriculture in the, especially in the Bloomington Normal area, but all kinds of other issues as well, ranging from how to transform dry cleaners and make it less toxic and things like that. So I'm so glad to hear what's going on there.
Yeah. Are there many groups like Living Upstream being formed or in getting down to work around the country?
Well, there really are. And one of the amazing discoveries I made when I published Living Downstream in 1997, you know, I went on the requisite 2-week book tour and essentially was on the road for almost 2 years with that book because so many different community groups, new and old, had formed to take up the question of how the health of the environment and the health of the people who lived in a certain community were related to each other. So I had the great honor of sitting down with groups ranging from Alaskan women who were worried about breast milk contamination because they actually, especially at high risk, because a lot of these pesticides travel in the jet stream until their condensation point is reached, and in cold climates they come back down to earth. So you actually see the highest breast milk contamination in mothers living north of the Arctic Circle. So I had a chance to talk with some of those communities. I had a chance to talk with Irish sheep farmers when I took the book, when the book was released in Ireland, because they do use a lot of organophosphate dips. They dip the insecticide dips for their sheep, and they were worried about water contamination. Mothers of kids with brain tumors living near Superfund sites in New Jersey, the deaf community in San Francisco. It just took me, it was a very big odyssey. And what I began to realize was that there's a new civil rights movement in this country, and it hasn't really been galvanized yet in the way that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. brought together so many different groups in the 1950s and 60s under his leadership. But I think it will happen. And these are mothers of children who are sick. They are firefighters who are worried about the kind of toxic chemicals they're exposed to when they fight fires. They're fashion designers worried about dry cleaning issues. Student athletes worried about fungicides being sprayed on the football fields where they're practicing. And all these different groups, women with breast cancer, mothers, farmers, are all joining together and forming important coalitions and becoming a really powerful social movement in this country. And I think it's an underreported story. But I think we're going to be hearing from these groups of people more and more in years to come.
Mm. Back to that meeting at the UN you had with some delegates there. What was the reception you received there? And what have they done? Have they done anything with the information?
Yeah, well, I was invited to Geneva in 1999. I guess Faith was about 11 months old when I went. And was able to witness and participate in some of the negotiations going on to formulate a treaty that would ban for worldwide use and production 12 very toxic chemicals, including some, I'm sure we've all heard of DDT, PCBs, and eventually phase out of practice the kind of activities that produce another very toxic chemical called dioxin. And one of the things I witnessed was that my government, the United States, was working very hard to scuttle this treaty. And I also was able to see that there were present at these negotiations representatives from some of our major chemical industries who were influencing very vigorously the delegates representing my country. And I began to feel ashamed that our policy in international negotiations was really being dictated by the chemical industry. But what I also saw was very, very powerful testimony from nursing mothers from far north of the Arctic Circle, including women from Alaska, but also women in Greenland, because women in Greenland turn out to have the worst breast milk contamination in the world. And, in fact, it's so bad that in some cases their children are not able to mount an immune response to vaccinations because the chemicals they're being exposed to both before birth and in breast milk have suppressed their immune system so severely. And they made a plea for the delegates to consider that this was a form of ecological genocide, that allowing the use and production of toxic chemicals that don't respect political boundaries but travel in the jet stream, travel in the ocean currents, find their way into the breasts of nursing mothers living thousands of miles away from where these things are being used, is a form of genocide. And that information and that testimony was so powerful, it actually won the day, together with some other very hard, good organizing work by a group of people called the International POPs Elimination Network. POPs is an acronym for Persistent Organic Pollutants. So I, in fact, was so inspired by their testimony that I chose, instead of presenting a very scientific discussion of the evidence for breast milk contamination, which is what I was charged to do, I actually went to the bathroom before I in the minutes before I was supposed to address the assembly, and expressed 4 ounces of breast milk, put it in a bottle, sealed it up, and passed that jar around to say, you know, these are the two true things about breast milk. It's the most contaminated food on the planet, and it's absolutely also a sacred communion between mother and child. Here's breast milk. Here's what it looks like. You are charged with authoring a treaty that could solve this problem. Please do it. And, I was one small voice in a whole big chorus of voices, but it felt very historical and very important. And my heart was pounding as well. I did it. You can imagine it kind of felt like taking your clothes off in front of a whole bunch of people in the United Nations. And it was very interesting to me because I could watch the bottle go around the room of all these delegates from, you know, all kinds of different nations and different cultures. And some of them looked at it and smiled and held it up to the light like it was a glass of fine wine. And some of them could hardly touch the bottle. They treated it like it was nuclear waste or something. And it was just a very arresting moment, I guess you'd say.
Wow. You know, it's funny that you mentioned it was a very personal moment. It was a very powerful moment for you. And I'm thinking now of your writing in the book about hiding the breast milk in the refrigerator.
Yeah, that's right. Only a few months earlier, when I was first learning how to breastfeed, I was a mother who had never seen breast milk before, as so many of us are. because although our whole branch of the primate tree, from chimps to everybody else, we're not born with the instinct to know how to breastfeed our children, and our children are born with the instinct to know how to do it. It's a learned behavior. It's like learning the tango. And for all parts of the primate tree, you'll learn to do it by watching other mother-infant pairs do it. But in our culture, we have somehow put breastfeeding behind closed doors and behind curtains and behind special nursing outfits so you do it discreetly. And I had never watched close-up a mother and child nurse before. And most women don't. So they go home alone from the hospital before their breast milk comes in. Suddenly, 3 days later, there's the breast milk, but you don't know what to do, and neither does your baby. And I've had a lot of help from a good lactation consultant to get it all figured out. And part of the process was learning how to use a breast pump. So because I had a very sleepy baby who wasn't that interested in nursing at first. So I had to keep my milk supply up until she kind of woke up and figured out what to do. I had to use a breast pump. And I looked at the stuff, and it looked really ugly to me. It looked like an old T-shirt. That, you know, it's a kind of, it's not even white, like cow's milk. It's kind of a gray-green color in this. And, of course, it's not homogenized, so you get this scum of cream that floats on the top. And I would hide it behind the pickles and the mayonnaise in the back of my refrigerator because I was embarrassed by it. So I guess that only makes it more ironic that I managed to pass a whole jar of it around the United Nations much later.
You write in the book that early motherhood is an extreme sport.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned about handling the demands of early motherhood?
Well, now that I'm the mother of two, I've had to learn it all over again. Of course, you know, we all know that sleep deprivation is a big part of it. But I actually found that even more challenging than trying to solve complicated problems while not having much sleep was the issue of having to pay attention all of the time. And I'm used to being a very busy person. But what I realized after I had Faith was that even on my busiest days, there are moments during the day where, you know, you're feeding the dog, you're getting the newspaper, you're walking to the post office, where you have these moments where you can just entertain your own thoughts. But when you're the mother of a tiny child, all those moments are confiscated and filled with trying to figure out what you should be doing with the baby. And so there's this kind of insanity factor that when you finally get a break, you know, like the new father says, why don't you go take a walk? I'll take over for a while. You get outside, and all of these suppressed thoughts come flooding back into your head, and it can feel a little bit crazy-making. And I think one is permanently altered by that. When you become a mother, there's this part of your brain that gets turned on. It's like an intercom system that's always paying attention, even when the child is asleep. And I think so far, my Faith is now 3, Elijah is now 6 months, I've never felt that intercom go off. It's always there, even sometimes when I'm, I'm still doing a lot of traveling and a lot of speaking. My husband often does the lion's share of the child care. And even when my kids are with him and I'm alone in a hotel room somewhere, I feel this sort of long-distance monitor radar working. And it's I don't hear enough conversation about that. It's a very profound transformation of oneself, probably more profound than getting married, more profound than having sex for the first time. It's the most even more profound than becoming a cancer patient and having a new identity with your own body. This new identity with my own brain has been a very intense and profound thing.
And for your husband, has he found early fatherhood an extreme sport?
Yes, I think he would agree with me on that, and we often have long discussions about, he's a sculptor and, you know, relies on a certain amount of, a lot of creativity has to happen for him to do his work, even more than mine. And I think part for him especially, having unstructured time where you can just muck around and tinker around in your studio, not knowing, you know, not having to say at 2 o'clock, I've got to be home, I've got to pick up this kid from nursery school, this one's got a nurse, that one did diaper change. You know, there's a kind of free-floating time that one needs to be a creative person. And we're both still trying to learn how to give each other that and how to move in and out of this endless circling time that is parenthood, because these tasks are not goal-directed. You know, you change a diaper once, then you change it again. You wash the laundry now, and then you're going to wash it again. It's this kind of Sisyphus thing where you're constantly rolling the stone up the hill, and it rolls back down, and you're rolling it back up again. And there's something wonderful about that in its non-linearity, in its cyclicalness. But if you're used to being a goal-directed person with, you know, who's crossing things off your list, or you're used to being able to go into your studio and just stay there and lose track of time and not have to get home at any given time, it can really alter your sense of how you're going to live the rest of your life.
Mm. You know, the book is about biology and ecosystems and science, and you write about it so beautifully, but also I think part of the beauty of the writing comes from the fact that all this is also very much about love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we often compartmentalize, you know, science, that part of our lives, and the, you know, what happens in the family circle. I mean, we don't see them as being related at all, but they really are, aren't they?
Well, they are, and even, you know, my attempt to unveil the various ways that toxic chemicals can flow through the breast and find its way into breast milk, it's all part of a love story for me. You know, the reason I want to talk about contaminants in mother's milk is because I do consider the breastfeeding relationship between mother and child a sacred bond and more profound than any other. And it's because I love my children so much. In fact, my husband coined this term called natal attraction to describe the way we love our children. You know, and if that kind of love were directed at another adult, it would be pathological. You know, because you realize you'd kill for these people. You'd lay down. You'd pick up arms for them. You'd empty your bank account for them. It's just so powerful. And for me as an ecologist, it means now that I have to use the tools of my profession and my knowledge and understanding about toxic chemicals to work for a world in which it's just unthinkable to use a chemical linked to birth defects or a chemical linked to lowered IQ in our economy, because sooner or later it will be released into the environment. Sooner or later it will find its way into a pregnant uterus or into the breasts of a nursing mother, and this is just a basic violation of our human rights.
Mm.
So I'll be working on this for some time to come, and it really is the stem, the root of my work is the love for my children now.
Yeah. We're here at the end of the time we can spend together today. However, to end, I would like you to read the very beginning of your book where you write about what it was like to be in the same room shortly after giving birth to your firstborn, Faith. And I think that here we'll get a true sense of the fierceness of natal attraction.
I think that's probably right. Okay, yeah, there's a kind of what you'd call in film a kind of establishing shot at the beginning of the book in which it opens the morning after I've given birth to Faith. And I had a pretty wonderful and ecstatic drug-free birth. And then I took her to the solarium the next day, and this is the place where I chose to give her the name Faith. And incidentally, I gave birth to my son Elijah in a slightly different venue. I chose a midwife-run birth center, and I named him Elijah after an Illinois abolitionist named Elijah Lovejoy. So when I say my daughter's name now, I think of the future, Faith, and when I say my son's name, Elijah, I think of the triumphs of the past, how we got rid of slavery. So here's where I decided to name her Faith. In the hospital solarium, sunlight pours through the glass like a warm shower. I have brought you here, little one, to show you the sky, blue as cornflowers, and the stone buildings of Boston, city of your birth. But you are sleeping and show no signs of changing your mind about sleeping. You spent last night nestled in the crook of my arm. I curled around you so the curves and bumps of your body, familiar to me as my own, pressed against my belly, pressed me now from the outside instead of from the inside. I recognize especially the curve of your heel. For many weeks, I felt it through my own skin, just under my left rib. At 3 a.m., you awoke. Your father said he looked over from his cot and saw you staring at a square of light on the wall. While I slept, he held you in his arms and made shadow puppets for you. He said that you watched intently, he emphasized intently, and that after he had run through his entire repertoire, you turned your attention to his face, holding him in a calm gaze. He said he knew in that moment what kind of person you would become. He said you have an observant, inquisitive spirit. Your left hand wiggles out now from the top of your swaddling blanket, but still you do not wake. The patterns of your veins make on the back of your hands is identical to my own. I cannot stop staring at you. No wonder mothers claim they cannot remember their labors clearly. You fill all my brain cells. Just the sound of your breathing, which is a miracle, requires my complete attention. The sea smell of your hair, the pulse behind your ear, the butter of your skin. I am so busy memorizing you, I cannot recall anything about my life before today. In the world outside this glass room, songbirds are feeding and resting in the trees. Some will take off tonight and not land until they reach Venezuela. Sandpipers, plovers, and broadwing hawks have already left for Patagonia and Panama. Bats are heading for caves in Kentucky and Tennessee. Out in the Atlantic, humpback whales pass by on their way to the Caribbean. Even now, Canada geese are honking toward us from Quebec. It is a good day for the beginnings of journeys. Every time I look at you, I think, now I cannot die. I decide your name is Faye.
Sandra, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, my great pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
You too.
Sandra Steingraber has been our guest this afternoon. She's the author of Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. And what she read is the opening scene of the book, Having Faith. The book is published by Perseus.